Hi, everybody. I'm Pete. I'm a recovered alcoholic. Grateful to be alive and sober and at a sacred place called Alcoholics Anonymous. And thank all of you for being here for me also. Loving God separated me from alcohol June 23rd, 1988. And by His power and grace, I've been kept separated from alcohol. And I'm here tonight as a recovered alcoholic, no longer, and I don't give this lip service, no longer suffering from a seemingly hopeless state of mind and body. Because of the power I've had an experience with and continue to experience in Alcoholics Anonymous, it has not only brought me sobriety, but something we talked about last week, emotional sobriety, and sobriety in a lot of other areas that I didn't know even existed when I walked into Alcoholics Anonymous, because I was settling on just staying away from a drink for 24 hours. And what I've found out over the last 16 years that we have our steps, and as a gentleman, a teacher has shown me that they are just a menu. We can go into a restaurant and look at the menu and study the menu and still go home hungry. And I can recite the menu to you, but still go home hungry. Yet, if I take some action, I won't go home hungry. And in Alcoholics Anonymous, I've heard many people over the years say, well, I read the big book. I read the big book all the time. And bless them, but they're running around Alcoholics Anonymous so untreated because they never took any action or had a teacher walk them through the big book of Alcoholics Anonymous. Because it isn't only going to big book studies that makes a difference in an alcoholic's life. It's having an experience with the information in the big book of Alcoholics Anonymous. So we need to take action to make the difference. And what I found out that there's so much behind each step. We're going to talk about step 12 tonight, begin step 12. And what we learned so far is, you know, what you see on the shades, there's so much more behind it. There's so much more depth and weight behind the wording on the shades. Same thing when we talk to our God and we offer up some words to our higher power. They're just words that convey a thought. But there's so much behind each word we speak to our God. When we talk about God, we can use all the words we want. The most learned man and woman in the whole world can talk about God the most eloquent way in the world, and yet it falls short. And that's what the steps are. They're bullets on a shade, but as we know, there's so much more behind it. There's so much more depth and weight. And I've mentioned it many, many times, how free do we want to get? God is limitless and powerful. How far do we want to go with this? There is no limit. God just keeps embracing us every step. A vision for us, a vision for you, a vision for me. God's constantly creating. And so my tendency my whole life was to, even in my early years in Alcoholics Anonymous, was to sit on the sidelines and say, okay, I'm waiting for God to send me in. And God's saying, let's go, I'm with you. All my endeavors in life, God walks with me. A vision for me, and God goes with me. Great stuff we experience in Alcoholics Anonymous. So I encourage everyone to seek experience. Seek the experience in this book, from the information in this book, and get someone who's been awakened because of the information in this book. If you're a real alcoholic, I pray your sponsor is a real alcoholic who's had an experience. Because you can be the real alcoholic and your sponsor, and we'll talk a little bit about this tonight, may be one of those moderate or hard drinkers in Alcoholics Anonymous. And he or she has the power to put the plug in a jug and play on the sober softball team, and their life is joyous, happy, and free. And it really is. But people like us, the any lengths we have to go to is not the same any lengths that the sponsor has to go to because they're a hard or moderate drinker. And us being the person on page 21, the real alcoholic, needs to go to those any lengths. And before I get off on a roll here, isn't it sad that we go to meetings of Alcoholics Anonymous, have an experience with the big book Alcoholics Anonymous, our basic text in Alcoholics Anonymous, and yet you share that from a podium or from the floor, and we look like the oddball in a meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous. We look like the ones who really have the problem. Oh, you're going to bring that in here now? It's kind of like going, if you're a Catholic, I'm a Catholic, and I went to church, and I brought a Bible with me to church, and people say, what are you bringing that thing here for? Makes absolutely no sense, but that's what goes on in some, not all, some contemporary AA meetings. Or if I'm an alcoholic, I want to talk about alcohol, and they look at you like weird because you're not talking about drugs in an AA meeting. That's what has happened. It's so easy. We can start off here, and the message gets so watered and gobbled down that where we wind up looks nothing like where we started off. And you know, if we walk into some AA meetings, contemporary AA meetings, it's not even therapy. It's bad group therapy. You're with me, right? So we're going to talk about step 12 tonight, and some of the things I want to God really touch on is one drunk working with another. What is the group doing? What is our own home group doing? What kind of message is my group passing on? I belonged to a home group in Brooklyn for years, and there was just a couple of us doing this deal, trying to pass a message on. But the theme of the group was don't drink and go to meetings. And little by slowly, more people started to take to this work, and we referred to as a group, don't go to those people because they talk about the big book there. So there was a shift within the group, and then it shifted back again. So what kind of messages is your home group carrying? What type of responsibility am I taking in carrying the message and sitting in a business meeting and trying to bring a message into that group? What kind of message am I carrying as an individual in Alcoholics Anonymous? In the third edition of Fly Page, it says, but the basic text, pages 1 to 164, have remained unchanged. This is the AA message. What message am I carrying as a recovered alcoholic? Am I saying I'm a recovered alcoholic at a meeting of AA and really have no idea what that means? But I say it because it sounds good and it becomes a language of knowledge rather than a language of experience. Great, tremendous responsibility we have and are given by loving God to work with another drunk. Great responsibility we have and are given to pass that message on within our group and to have a group conscience. What does our group represent? Are we a bunch of non-drinking society that meets every, you know, Monday night at 8 o'clock? Or are we recovered alcoholics looking for a new prospect to pass the message on? You study our history, and there were many times in the early days before a member was brought to a meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous, they went through the steps. And then they were brought to a meeting. Doesn't happen that way now. Treatment centers have a lot to do with that. I'm not going to get into an outside issue, but I would love to. What is my group carrying? What kind of message am I carrying? I hope to talk a lot about 12-step calls. I was at a meeting in Brooklyn one time, and a guy came down there, fired up, right off the street. God be my witness, people says, oh, my God, he's drunk. There's a meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous. Oh, my God, he's drunk. Had no clue what to do with a wet one. But my God guided me to that guy with the big book, and he was pretty incoherent, but I sat with him. As much as I can get through, I tried. Because I thought of Ebby sitting down with Bill. Right? He continued to get drunk, and I don't even know if he's alive anymore, but that's the way I was brought up in AA. That's what we do. So I like to talk a lot about 12-step calls, which, again, we don't hear enough about in Alcoholics Anonymous. I don't know why. Maybe because people come in after treatment and have cleaned up and sobered up. I don't know. But what a good deal to make a 12-step call, as difficult and as tiring as they can be. It's what we do. My 16 years of experience, that's what we do. One drunk working with another. Sure, we have conventions and conferences and studies and all these wonderful things and these AA fellowship outings. But if we ever lose one drunk working with another, this is an empty room tonight. Our society is gone. Our fellowship is gone when we lose one drunk working with another. And it isn't about, well, you know, give me a call and we'll talk. Well, sure, we can talk, but what are we talking about? You're on the other end of the phone dying, and I want to talk to you about my dramas or life, or maybe talk about your issues or talk about your feelings. No, we're going to teach you how to recover from a seemingly hopeless state of mind and body. I'm going to give you information. You're going to come to my house, and with this information that you will have an experience with, you will recover. That's a guarantee from my big book, and then you will get another prospect, go into the fellowship and pull him or her out, and watch them recover, and they will go back in, and then we meet here tonight with 100 strong. That's what we do. And it's a great responsibility. I hope I don't ruffle too many feathers with the next topic I'd like to cover over the next couple of weeks, and that is one drunk, one alcoholic working with another alcoholic. Alcoholics Anonymous, we talk about alcohol. And what people hear is, well, you're throwing me out. No, we're not. But there's a thing called singleness of purpose, and in our 12 and 12 it says, shoemaker, stick to thy last. How arrogant of me to think I can work with someone who's addicted to crack cocaine. When I try that stuff once or twice and said it's not for me and walked away from it, I'm not an addict. I did drugs, but I'm not an addict. What I am is an alcoholic of the hopeless variety. So let me never be so arrogant as to think I can take on all the ills of the world and solve everyone's problem. I will lovingly guide, as we ought to in Alcoholics Anonymous, lovingly guide you and even take you to a fellowship that works for you so you can go home. But please don't come into my house and puke on my rug and expect me to clean it up. And you want to know something? I will. We talked about this a few weeks ago in Pennsylvania at a conference. I will. I will clean it up. But please respect my home next time you come into it. We come into a meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous. I'm an alcoholic. I have no identification with the crackhead or people who maybe do other sorts of drugs. So please respect our home. It's vital to what we do here. It's vital to what we do. I see some chairs shifting already. But that's the real deal for Alcoholics Anonymous. One drunk working with another. The neat thing is, if you have a sponsor and you're not sure, am I an alcoholic, am I an addict, am I both, the sponsor who's gone through this work has had an experience with it, he or she will walk you through the first 43 pages of this book, and somewhere in there, God willing, you will find truth in that. I have a dear friend of mine, I think I shared this about a month ago, he wanted to be an A, an AA, an NA, a CA, some A. He was none of these. And I remember a sponsor, we were down in Philadelphia, and the sponsor says, from my end, what you need to do is sit with a therapist. You experience no phenomenon of craving, no addiction to drugs. Maybe you need to sit with a therapist. And he was leveled by it. What do I do now? This was his hub for friendship. And through some trial and error, he found his way. And he's never been happier. Finding the truth that, hey, I'm not an alcoholic, I'm not an addict, maybe I just need to sit with a professional once or twice a week. Sometimes it sounds like the gates of hell closed on you, and it's just the opposite. So we have a responsibility here to show people truth, help them find truth, part of carrying this message. I've tried to work with non-alcoholics. I had little success because I would listen to their story and have very little identification with it. And then they would hear my experiences have even less identification with it. I will lovingly guide you to a home. And while we're on that, a few quick stories. I was a guy had come to me relapsing in and out of Alcoholics Anonymous for a very long time. And he says, can you sponsor me? I said, sure. A book talks about my convincing he's an alcoholic. And I wasn't. And I said, where you need to go is another fellowship. And I'll take you there. I visited this place and I will take you there. And anyway, he was really angry with me, and I said to him, well, that's one of the any lengths. I'd like you to visit another fellowship a few times a week. That's really from where I'm sitting, where you need to be. You're not an alcoholic. I listened to your story. You drank maybe once or twice, never experienced the allergy, but you're a full-blown heroin addict. Anyone can see that and hear that. Very, very angry with me, never spoke to me again, walked out of my life. And I made prayer for him, tried to reach him a few times, wouldn't have anything to do with me. Not too long ago, I'm coming out of a cigar store in Staten Island, and one of my addictions, by the way, my last vice that I have, smoking cigars, and a big pickup truck rolls up, and I hear the horn beep, and I hear, hey, you, and I say, oh, boy, who'd I piss off on, hey, this time, and he got out of the truck, and he said, I've been looking for you, and he had all these keychains hanging from his waist, and he told me he had just made a year clean in another fellowship. And he had all the keychains because they give away all these keychains. And he told me, he says, when you gave me that information, I was really angry with you. He says, but I went there to spite because I honor resentment. And I walked into a meeting of this fellowship and I caught the back end of a speaker's talk. And he says, for the first time, I realized I was home And I've been going to that fellowship since, and my life has never been better. And he was there to thank me. And at the time, he was angry with him. And God gave me enough courage to lovingly guide this guy to his home, and his life's never been better, compared to in and out of Alcoholics Anonymous, where he can never identify and continually use. So if I'm looking to sponsor people to have a friend, I may be in the wrong business. Because if you know, if you sponsor people and you've been doing this a long time, you're going to get people angry with you. The truth is not always pleasant to hear. Even if I'm working with another drunk and I'm walking them through some other steps and I need to pull covers every so often and shout truth at you, it isn't, my sponsor does it with me. It isn't pleasant. But it's part of our responsibility that we have. Sometimes we're Alcoholics Anonymous a while and we forget about that this is an illness that wants me dead, will settle for me drunk. It's out to kill every one of us. And we get comfortable and they forget exactly what we're dealing with. A disease that wants to kill me and will be very happy with me picking up a drink tonight and not showing up here in a couple of weeks. We'd love it. Let's never lose sight of that. What we're really doing here is God is demonstrating through me what he can do, through you what he can do to save another drunk's life. Then we wake up in here, and the question I ask you to consider as we go through this 12-step is my life hidden in the rooms of Alcoholics Anonymous? We can hide out in the rooms of Alcoholics Anonymous. Or am I bringing joy to people's lives outside of Alcoholics Anonymous? Do I have a life outside of Alcoholics Anonymous? I've always shared many times that this is my life, Alcoholics Anonymous. This has allowed me to do a lot of other things with it. I don't hide out in Alcoholics Anonymous. I do wonderful things with my life that God allows me to do. For example, taking these principles into my home, occupation, and affair, and being a good citizen again, being a useful member to my family. Instead of hiding out, you know, knocking out 3-4 meetings a week, and we don't take our wives out to dinner. We don't take the kids to amusement park because I have my, you know, meeting to make tonight, and you go to the amusement park, I'll catch up to you. We pack into the mainstream. We're given this gift of sobriety. We're given this spiritual awakening, spiritual experience, the spiritual revolution. We need to go with it, but never forget home, here. Alcoholics Anonymous, a lot of AA is top-heavy on fellowship. Contemporary AA is meeting makers, make it 90 meetings in 90 days, make more meetings, double up on your meetings, meetings, meeting, meetings. Wonderful thing. It's one side of our triangle. And the other thing you'll hear a lot of is what is so limited in vision that service is only setting up and breaking down and making coffee. There's another service called One Drunk Working with Another, and that's where AA is heavy. Very little about working through this big book, the other part of our triangle. And it's easy to get caught up in making meetings. Those same meetings will use the success of my external world to judge how my internal world is doing. That is the remedy for my success. That is the remedy to judge, to gauge my sobriety. How are you doing? Great. I have a new job, just bought a new house, and just came back from vacation, and I have about $200 in my pocket, so I'm a spiritual giant. No, how are you doing? How's your practice? What practice? How's your prayer meditative life? And you get to look at what a deer in the headlights look. But really, that's what we're about. We're able to do those great things. I've heard tremendous success stories in Alcoholics Anonymous. People going back to school and becoming lawyers. People going back to school and owning companies and just wonderful things. And very other successes like being allowed back in a family and becoming a member of that family again. All great successes. But what we do here is help people experience the power of God by passing on some information. That's what we do. That's what we're about in here. One drunk working with another. You want to see the love of God? I've shared this a million times from a podium. Watch another drunk in a parking lot, whether it's after this meeting or your own home group, when the meeting breaks up, one drunk working with another. Or before the meeting. Or on the phone at 2:00 in the morning or midnight, where our pleasures are interrupted. TV's interrupted. Because a drunk on the other phone is in really serious trouble. And we, God gives us the power to walk him or her through a very dark, lonely night. That's the power of God. That's the love of God working. And I pray I never, ever lose sight of that. Forget that. Because I know what it's like being on that other end of the phone. when you feel like there's no way out. A couple of things we can consider. What allows a person to be a member of Alcoholics Anonymous is not what brings a person to be recovered. The only requirement for membership is a desire to stop drinking. A desire to stop drinking, first of all, may not last very long before we're overwhelmed by the desire, by the obsession to drink again. And a desire to stop drinking will not bring me to a place called recovered. Yet many of our contemporary AA meetings say, you remember when you say you are? Sure. If you say you're an alcoholic, okay. And you belong here. But that's not the beginning and end of it all. Having a desire to stop drinking is not going to bring me to a place called recovered. It's inadequate. It's insufficient. It's incomplete. Contemporary A will have you think that if you just come to meetings, put the plug in a jug, meeting makers, make it, make what? I'm still trying to figure out 16 years later. Maybe make it to a place called very, very untreated with no spiritual revolution. And what about the responsibility we have to another drunk? I'm a member of AA when I say I am. Sure, no one's sizing us up at the door or qualifying us at the door. Welcome. That's the great thing about Alcoholics Anonymous. But what about a responsibility to the next drunk who really needs a message, who really needs some information on how to recover? Because we could hang around Alcoholics Anonymous a while, and then sooner or later we're going to ask to speak. And after a talk, someone's going to say, can you sponsor me? And all I got for them is put the plug in the jug. And they're dying. And they get drunk. And the person who says put the plug in the jug replies they didn't want it enough. Or they did. You didn't have enough information and you didn't have an experience to pass on. But your ego got so big in Alcoholics Anonymous, you didn't have it in you to say, go see him or go see her because they're doing a deal in the big book. They'll save your life. I can only take you this far. Reconstruction of ego, and most don't even know it. But people die on that. Very often we're looking to save people outside of Alcoholics Anonymous, and the detox and the rehab is a great thing, and many of us are dying right in here. We have an untreated sponsor. Guess what? You're having an untreated prospect. My experience has proven to me many, many times, if there's problems within a group, if there's problems with the group not following traditions, if there's problems with the prospect, most often I got to look who the sponsor is. What's the sponsor doing? Because if you're doing this deal, you know it's a great responsibility to pass this message on to the people we're sponsoring so they can wake up, have their own experience, not my experience, their own experience, and then go back in there again. So it's about being awake and informed. And informed. Tradition 5 in the 12 and 12 says, each Alcoholics Anonymous group ought to be a spiritual entity. I'll say it again. Each Alcoholics Anonymous group ought to be a spiritual entity having but one primary purpose, that of carrying its message to the alcoholic who still suffers. Again, that's what we do here. I was in Brooklyn, and there was a gentleman another guy who was a heroin addict, coming to AA meetings and couldn't get sober. And everyone told him, keep coming back, keep coming back, keep coming back. The steps will get you before you get them. They found him dead in a park across the street from a meeting in Bay Ridge, Brooklyn. And everyone came back to the meeting on the Saturday night meeting and said, oh, poor guy, he died, what a sin. He didn't want it enough. And I was sharing, and I got some people angry with me with my comment, but it went something like, those of us who didn't lovingly guide that guy to another fellowship that deal with Narcotics Anonymous need to take the hit for his death because we have a responsibility. And that didn't go over too well. But ain't it the truth? The guy was a pure heroin addict, and people told him, keep coming back to AA, rather than, you know what, there's another fellowship that you may feel at home at and can identify with, and people of your type are there, like Alcoholics Without Type here. I have a couple of guys in Staten Island I know who are crackheads and have been relapsing longer than I am sober in Alcoholics Anonymous. Refuse to go to a CA meeting. Refuse. And they're dying. And many people at their groups tell them, keep coming back. Keep coming back. They're going to die. And then we'll say they didn't want it enough. It's part of working with others. It's part of carrying this message. We forget that. Not you guys. We forget that as a whole, as a fellowship in Alcoholics Anonymous, how important this is. And if you're on the firing line, God will keep us safe and protected and unharmed. And really, we're in the trenches many times. We're on the firing line, and part of that firing line is giving another person truth. Chapter 7, Working with Others, page 89. Step 12 says, having had a spiritual awakening as a result of these steps, we try to carry this message to other alcoholics in the original printing set to others, especially alcoholics, and to practice these principles in all our affairs. So that's a tall order. There's three parts to that step. When we get to working with others, they don't talk about having had a spiritual experience, because step 10 says we've entered the world of the spirit, we've had it. You had your experience. You've been given one. Sure, we have to continue to grow in understanding and effectiveness and continually seek this power and work with disciplines, but you've had an experience, and it tells us what to do with it. Remember, resting on our laurels, we're headed for trouble if we do. What do? With this message? We go work with another drunk and take this experience, these principles, into our home, occupation, and affairs. So chapter 7 gets right into some guiding principles, some guidelines on how to work with another drunk. I think I shared this a few weeks ago. My message is the same. My approach will change depending on the drunk. I had a guy I had to take to a detox, and he was in my car and insisted on driving. He was just fired up, lit up, and he wanted to drive to the detox, and he wanted to take me on a scenic route through Staten Island. And I had to bark at the guy. I did a 12-step call one time on a guy who was falling down the steps into a subway. And the gentleman who told me we're going to make a 12-step call on this guy who's also dead today, I'll call you at 7. We're going to get him at 8 and take him out to this detox in Staten Island. And he called me around 7:30 and said, I can't make it. And so I go to meet this guy, and I take him to this hospital alone, not recommended. And this guy was in really serious, serious trouble. And he started banging on my dashboard and having these crying jags. And so my message to him was the same, but I got really loud and barked at him, hoping he'd believe I was angry. I tell you the truth, because I was really kind of nervous about it. My message is the same, but the approach. I sponsored guys in the past where you have to bark a little bit, and other guys you can talk very calmly to. The message doesn't change. Over the years, I've been guilty of watering it down because I wanted you to recover more than you did. And I've been guilty of ramming it down your throat because I wanted you to recover more than you did. And God has moved me to a place as I give it away. And I give away truth on my experience. So we get right into working with others. It says practical experience shows that nothing will so much ensure immunity, I like you to circle the word immunity, from drinking as intensive, and I like you to circle the word intensive, this is a great promise, as intensive work with other alcoholics. Intensive work is a lot more than saying, here's my phone number, give me a call. Intensive work. It works when other activities fail. This is our 12th suggestion. Carry this message to other alcoholics, this message that's been given to us in this book. Great promises. We can help when no one else can. We can secure their confidence when others fail. Remember that they are very ill. And the reason we can do that is because we've been in the same ditch that they're currently in, and we know the way out. We know where they are. Life will take on new meaning. To watch people recover, to see them help others, to watch loneliness vanish, to see a fellowship grow up around about you and them. to have a host of friends. This is an experience you must not miss. And I take statements and I turn them into questions. Does my life take on new meaning when I work with someone? Do I see people recover and watch them help others? Do I watch loneliness vanish from them as well as me and see a fellowship go up around them as well as me? We commence shoulder to shoulder this common journey. We seek the fellowship we crave. We create the fellowship we crave. It grows up around us. We seek this message. We go to those hot spots in AA, those places that are on fire, to look for this message. And then we go visit the sordid spots and look for a prospect. Is that happening? Or am I going to a meeting, a second column meeting, contributing to the second column meeting, and then going home and being restless, irritable, and discontented? And when someone comes to ask me to sponsor them, I shake. Because it means I have a responsibility now. And I say, you know what, you should go see him. When I'm on with the facts, but I don't want to be inconvenienced. Am I doing any of that stuff? There's a wake-up call. And only we know that when we look in the mirror. It says, we know you will not want to miss it. Frequent contact with newcomers and with each other is the bright spot of our lives. It says, perhaps you're not acquainted with any drinkers who want to recover. You can easily find somebody asking a few doctors, ministers, priests, or hospitals. They'd be glad to assist you. It tells us not to start out as an evangelist or reformer. Well, unfortunately, a lot of prejudice exists. And I've done that in my early days. I try to reform people. I, you know, preach to them and bark at them and see the light kind of talks with them. And it went nowhere. They couldn't wait for me to go home. But there's something in AA that we do, and I'm not fond of the term, but it's the only one that's coming to me now, and that's hooking a drunk, baiting a drunk. We talk to them. If they're in a light mood, we're in a light mood. If they're in a serious mood, we'll be in a serious mood. But we talk to them, and we get them to a place where, well, what did you do? How did you get to where you are? Because that's a question I was always asking. Well, how did you get to where you are? And I was so shallow, I would judge you by immediately on how you looked. And you looked great, and that was interesting to me. And then you would tell me about this life you were living, and I would say, well, what did you do? And God put people who were armed with the facts who told me what they did. And they had me, because the way I was living was killing me. It says, ministers and doctors are competent and you can learn much from them if you wish. But it happens that because of your own drinking experience, you can be uniquely useful to other alcoholics. So cooperate, never criticize. To be helpful is our only aim. And on that spirit of working with others and to be helpful, and one drunk identifying with another, I'm going to ask us to go over to on the third edition, page 157, in A Vision for You. And they're talking about Bill Dotson, our third alcoholic here. And watch what these guys do, Bill and Bob. In this story, he asks why is he down at a ward? He was always in, why is he in a private room? He was always up in a ward. And the deal with that was you were up in a ward, and usually when you were going to pass away and you're really ill, they brought you down to this private room. So here's this drunk being brought down to a private room, and he asks Bill and Bob, why'd you bring me down here? How bad am I? He thought he was about to sign his papers and go home to the Lord. So here he is. He's a little bit nervous. And watch what they do here. He says, this private room, I was always in a ward before. And it says, we're giving you treatment. We're giving you treatment for alcoholism. We're not here to talk about your issues and your feelings. We're giving you treatment. These guys are not doctors. I mean, Dr. Bob was. But they come there as drunks. And they're going to give him treatment for alcoholism. It says, hopelessness was written large on the man's face as he replied, that's no use. Nothing is going to fix me. I'm a goner. Next paragraph says, for an hour, the two friends told him about their drinking experiences. They qualified for the guy. One drunk with another. This is what I'm about. I'm not a priest. I'm not a minister. I'm not a doctor. I'm not a therapist. I'm a drunk. Can you identify with my story? And they tell, the two of them tell him of their drinking experiences. Over and over, listen what he does. He would say, that's me, that's me, I drink like that. So they're on an even playing field here, a level field. You're like me. You drank like me. You experienced the same horrors I experienced. We're one. Next paragraph says, the man in the bed was told of the acute poisoning from which he suffered and how it deteriorates the body of an alcoholic. They told him about the phenomenon of craving. That the craving is always intensified, never satisfied. They told him about the physical allergy here and what it does to us. And then what do? And how it warps his mind. There was much, like you to circle the word much, much talk about the mental state preceding the first drink. So they're telling him about the body, what goes on in the body, they're telling him about why you keep going back to a drink when separated. So they don't only qualify for the guy, they tell him about the phenomenon of craving and the obsession preceding the first drink. These guys were armed with the facts. No nonsense. They went in and gave it to him. But they qualified for the guy. Let's skip down. Next to last paragraph, same page, it says, the two friends spoke of their spiritual experience and told them about the course of action they carried out. So they talked to them freely about this God they had an experience with and how they got it. It wasn't like, well, he's new, he's not ready for God yet. This guy's laying in a bed dying and they're coming at him with God. They qualified for him, the phenomenon called craving, the obsession that precedes the first drink, and this is how we got better. We had an spiritual experience, and this was the path we took. Well, he's new. Let him talk about his feelings, Bill. You know, hey, Bob, let's find out what his issues are. Maybe he comes from a dysfunctional family and has enablers. Let's sign him up for the sober softball team this weekend. There's a sober dance happening at, you know, St. such and such church. No, they went in because there's a guy dying and I had to help him. And that's what they did. Flip over, please. Page 158, first full paragraph. It says, next day, the prospect, they found the prospect more receptive. He had been thinking it over. He says, maybe you're right. God ought to be able to do anything. Next paragraph. On the third day, the lawyer gave his life to the care and direction of his creator and said he was perfectly willing to do anything necessary. The guy is willing to go to any lengths. Last sentence, it says, he had begun to have a spiritual experience. Next paragraph, five sentences down. He had found God, and in finding God, he had found himself. That was June 1935. He never drank again. He, too, has become respected and useful member of his community, not only his AA friends. He has helped. Look what he did. He helped other men recover. Skip down. It says, so you see, there were three alcoholics in that town who now felt that they had to give to others what they had, what they found, or be sunk. They got it, and they went out looking for others. They passed it on. To me, one of the most powerful stories in this book. Do I do that? Does my home group do that? Are we doing that in Alcoholics Anonymous? It doesn't have to be a hospital bed. It could be someone here coming saying, I got 2 days back. Case in point, I'm at a meeting in New Jersey, in my town where I live. The meeting starts off like this. After they read their preamble and secretary notes, if they didn't read the preamble, I didn't know where I was. Anyone care to start the meeting off tonight? And one gentleman said he was driving down this, I think it's called Highway or Route 22 out here, and he saw a couple of watering holes that he remembered. He doesn't know how he got to the meeting tonight, he said. He's because I've been thinking about drinking all day and I know I'm going to drink. Can someone help me? I can't stop drinking. I don't know how I got here tonight. The very next gentleman shared about getting laid off from work. And the next person says, I identify with that guy who got laid off from work because I was out of work for a long time. And that guy was left on his own. In a meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous. How pathetic. How sad. And I made my way over to that guy because I know what I'm supposed to do in here. And those powers that be took him. And I don't know where he is now. We got him. We'll take care of him. And they interrupted my talking to this guy and took him under their wing. I don't know where he is. The people says, I got laid off from work and I can identify with you, while he was dying in a corner. But even give him the dignity to say, we're like you. We know what it's like to be there. And make the meeting directed at that guy who's going to drink. Shift in the meeting. We got a new guy who's looking to drink. Let's direct it at him. Newcomer is the most important person at a meeting, yes? If I'm sound asleep, me and my 16 years think I am. I'm not sound asleep, thank God. One more thing in the vision for you. Page 162, please. On the bottom, last sentence, it says, thus we grow, and so can you. Though you be but one man or woman with this book in your hand, we believe and hope it contains all you will need to begin. We know that, we know what you're thinking. You're saying to yourself, I'm jittery and alone. I couldn't do that. You can. You forget you have just now tapped into a source of power much greater than yourself. To duplicate with such backing what we have accomplished is only a matter of willingness, patience, and labor. We know of an AA member who was living in a large community, and I think they're talking about Hank Parkhurst here. He lived there but a few weeks when he found that the place probably contained more alcoholics per square mile than in any city in the country. This was only a few days ago at this writing. The authorities there were much concerned. He got in touch with a prominent psychiatrist who had undertaken certain responsibilities for the mental health of the community. The doctor proved to be able and exceedingly anxious to adopt any workable method of handling the situation. So we inquired, what did our friend have on the ball? Our friend, Hank Parkhurst, proceeded to tell him. And with such good effect, the doctor agreed to test among his patients and certain other alcoholics from the clinic which he attends. Arrangements were also made with the chief psychiatrist of a large public hospital to select still others from the stream of misery which flows through that institution. So our fellow worker will soon have friends galore. Some of them may sink and perhaps never get up, but if our experience is a criterion, more than half of those approached will become fellows of Alcoholics Anonymous. When a few men in the city have found themselves and have discovered the joy of helping others to face life again, there will be no stopping until everyone in that town has had this opportunity to recover if he can and will. Great promise of what we do in Alcoholics Anonymous in a chapter called A Vision for You, A Vision for Me, A Vision for Us. Great stuff. Let's go back to working with others. Page 90. It says, when you discover a prospect for Alcoholics Anonymous, find out all you can about him. If he does not want to stop drinking, don't waste time trying to persuade him. Third edition, page 186. We there? It says, don't waste time trying to persuade him. They're working with a drunk here, alcoholic number 3. And this is Bill Dotson telling his story. What does Bill and Bob say? Well, I believe he's worth saving and working on. They ask him, do you want to quit drinking? It's none of our business about your drinking. We're not up here trying to take any of your rights or privileges away from you, but we have a program by which we think we can stay sober. Part of that program is that we take it to someone else that needs it and wants it. Now, if you don't want it, we'll not take up your time. We'll get going and look for someone else. Many times, I'm trying to give it away to person A who doesn't want it, and person B is banging on my door. I was down in Pennsylvania a couple of weeks ago, and a few people came up to me about this situation. I have trying to sponsor this terrific person. They're terrific people. But they won't take the action to make the difference. They keep saying, I want to do this. They keep saying, I want to go through the book. Their actions are proving differently. What do I do? And I brought them to this. Because sometimes we get that prospect that touches our heart. And it's difficult to say no. It was difficult just to let them go. But they don't want to take the action. And my book points that out right here, what Bill and Bob did. If you don't want to, we'll let you drink. Maybe you'll get to that place, that bitter end, and then you'll come knock on my door. I'm always standing ready to help. Back to page 90. It says, if he does not want to stop drinking, don't waste time trying to persuade him. You may spoil a later opportunity. Another drunk, if they survive it, may be their convincer. May be what brings them to, or him or her to truth. This advice is given for his family also. They should be patient, realizing they were dealing with a sick person. A few weeks ago, a month ago or so, I talked about a guy who we took to a hospital like a whole bunch of times within a matter of like 24 hours. It was unbelievable. He kept signing himself out. And I counseled with the wife. I counseled with the family. I counseled with his mom. And we went to the hotel and tried to take him out. We got him out. And he was drinking himself to death. And we were armed with the facts. We told him about the allergy, the obsession of the mind. He needed a spiritual experience. And he kept saying, I'm going to stop because I love my daughter. He had a picture of his daughter in front of him. And the vodka and the beer was going down. I'll stop because of her. And I said, well, let's stop now if you love her so much. And he couldn't. And he's been drinking. Got a call from his mom again. Got a call from another family member about him. Now he's locked in his room. He doesn't come out and he's drinking himself to death. And we've tried to make approaches and he wants nothing to do with us from AA. I'm going to stop is his reply. And we sit and I found out all I can about this guy. What he does for a living, his religious leanings, how many times he's been in AA, how many times he's been to rehab, what else is he taking behind alcohol. I get the whole deal on this guy, and then we go. Sometimes we're not so fortunate where we just get a blind 12-step call and we go. But this guy, I sat with his family, and I still sit with his family like I did, even though he's drinking. And he still doesn't want to do this deal. He's locked in his room and doesn't come out. And he's... I hope he doesn't die. Trying to tell the family, as they ask me, Peter, what can you tell him that'll make him, you've been in AA for a long time, can't you tell him something? What can you tell him to make him stop drinking? What can I tell him? Hit him with truth? Father, emotional appeal seldom suffices. Totally powerless. Hit him with truth over and over and over again. What can I tell them? How do you sit down and tell a family member whose heart is broken, who's in tears on the other end of the phone, my son, my daughter, my husband, my wife are drinking themselves to death? Can't you do anything? Recently I've had that, and many times I've had that. We forget we die in Alcoholics Anonymous. And as we drink and die, lives are touched by that. So I get a plug to say this. How arrogant to say when I come into Alcoholics Anonymous, all I have to do is not drink. Because I hope this guy sobers up and then he goes back to his mom, his wife, and his children and make amends for this because they're dying now and they're not drinking. You see how arrogant it is? How selfish and self-centered to say all I have to do today is not drink when they die with us. But in here, we're given great, great power to go back and fix. And let those people sleep nights because we're on a path of freedom. My dad sleeps at night. My brothers sleep at night because of what I've been given here. And I sat with them and made amends. Next paragraph says, if there is any indication that he wants to stop, have a good talk with the person most interested in him. And sometimes, like I said, we don't get this opportunity. We get a blind trust to call, hey, what are you doing? We need to go. And we go. I was on a list with New York Intergroup, and they would call me up, hey, we got a drunk, can you go get him? And they knew less about him than I did. You know. And I grab a guy, and we go, and we take this guy to a detox or wherever. We'll take him to a meeting. It says usually his wife, that's the person most interested, or I guess the husband, if we're making a call on one of our woman alcoholics. get an idea of his behavior, his problems, his background, the seriousness of his condition, and his religious leanings. You need this information to put yourself in his place to see how you would like to him to approach you if the tables were turned. And here's my experience on this. If I'm going on a 12-step call, what I've done many times, and I watched the elders do this. Example, if I'm paying a call on someone who may be a lawyer, and I'm not, and you're a lawyer, I'm going to let you do the lead here. I'm going to let you talk to them. You guys have something in common besides awkward. Maybe you can penetrate that way. I'll let someone else do the talking, maybe has more experience, has something in common besides the alcohol to hook the guy. And I'll support. This guy I was just talking about, I went with a friend to this Holiday Inn to pull this guy out. And he knew this guy a lot longer than I did. And I was the stranger. And I said to him, Anthony, you take the lead on this. You do the most of the talking because he knows you. You guys got drunk together. And that's what we did. We got him out of the hotel, and he signed himself out of the hospital anyway. But sometimes we do things like that. What we're walking into. It's really important. We hear many times to go two people or more on a 12-step call. I've learned the hard way. One of the reasons why we do that. We can walk into a house, and it can become violent quick. I like to scope out the house I'm walking into if I'm walking into a strange house because I have no idea what this drunk is capable of doing on a drunk. Are there knives laying around? Are there weapons laying around? What's laying around the house that I'm in? I'm in a stranger's house and someone who may be violent and capable of doing anything on a drunk. So we go together. And if anything happens, we need to call the police. We need to do that. We need to call an ambulance. We need to do that. So I'm real careful about when I walk in, what I'm walking into if I'm going in on a blind 12-step call. Sometimes it is wise to wait till the drunk goes on a binge. The family may object to this, they always do, but unless he is in a dangerous physical condition, it is better to risk it. He finishes up the drunk, he or she, we may get that lucid interval where now we can get them after they come off a drunk. Don't deal with him when he is very drunk unless he is ugly and a family needs your help. Wait for the end of a spree or at least a lucid interval. I've worked with drunks while they're wet. I've worked with drunks after they come off a binge. That lucid interval, sometimes it's easy to penetrate and hook them. When they're in the throes, they're thinking about the next drink, and it's been very difficult to work with drunks like that. And sometimes you just put them to bed and wait for the next morning. I've done that. I've 12-step guys with other AA members. I remember my very first 12-step call. We took this guy who's also dead today. I knew him when I was drinking, and he got me out of a lot of ugly scrapes that because of him, if it wasn't for him, I wouldn't even be here. Running through some rough neighborhoods. I get sober and he dies from alcoholism. But he was in the backseat of a car, getting sick on himself, having a crying jag, then laughing the next moment, and then throwing up on himself again, and we got him to the hospital. And the next morning I went to work and he was on the corner panhandling money. And I remember thinking, what did I do wrong? I called my sponsor. I blew it. Took this guy to a hospital yesterday, he's back on a corner, and I didn't do anything wrong. I stood sober through it and tried to help another drunk. But that's what happens many times. You know, they're on a corner faster than we're home. But we look for the next one or take that guy back again. Next paragraph says, if he does not want to see you, never force yourself upon him. Neither should the family hysterically plead with him to do anything, nor should they tell him much about you. They should wait for the end of his next drinking bout. You may place this book where he or she can see in the interval. Here, no specific rule can be given. And I always let God guide me with this. The family must decide these things. Urge them not to be over-anxious, for that might spoil matters. Do you see how many times they mention the family in these couple of pages? More than once, more than twice. Because the family suffers from alcoholism also. family afterwards says years of living with an alcoholic will make any wife or child neurotic. The whole family is to some extent ill. They suffer from alcoholism and they didn't do anything. Some of them don't even drink socially. Great responsibility we have once we have this experience, practice these principles in all my affairs. Book says, homes first, occupations and affairs. Am I taking this home once I get it? Page 91, second paragraph. It says, when your man is better, the doctor might suggest a visit from you. Though you have talked with the family, leave them out of the first discussion. Under these conditions, your prospect will see he is under no pressure. He feel he can deal with you without being nagged by his family. And I have found another meaning to that, confidentiality. What I tell you, you're not going to run back and tell my husband or wife or my boss. It's between us. Confidentiality. It's sacred. You talk to me and it stays here. Whatever you tell me. One drunk working with another in the kitchen while the family's in the living room. I walk out. What'd he say? First, you know. Did they tell you the time they did this? And all to be expected. And I give a very general reply. I won't break that confidence. Because if I break that, it's okay for you to break it. If it's okay for you to break it, it's okay for them to break it. And then we don't have anything here anymore. It's that vital, confidentiality. Under these conditions, his prospect will see he is under no pressure. He feel he can deal with you without being nagged by his family. Call on him while he is still jittery. He may be more receptive when depressed. See your man alone if possible. At first, engage in some general conversation. After a while, turn to talk to some phase of drinking. Tell him enough about your drinking habits. Remember what Bill and Bob did with Bill D. Symptoms and experience to encourage him to speak of himself. If he wishes to talk, let him do so. You will thus get a better idea how you ought to proceed. If he's not communicative, give him a sketch of your drinking career up to the time you quit. So we're baiting the guy. This is how I drank and I quit, and this is my experience. He's going to ask, what did you do? We speak about God freely here. If he's in a serious mood, dwell on the troubles look as cause you, being careful not to moralize a lecture. If his mood is light, tell him numerous stories of your drinking escapades. Get him to tell some of his. When he sees you know all about the drinking game, commence to describe yourself as an alcoholic. Most of them know it anyway. Tell him how baffled you were, how you finally learned that you were sick. Give an account of your struggles you made to stop. Show him the mental twist which leads to the first drink. We suggest we do this on the chapter on alcoholism, chapter 3 in our book. So we're going to talk to this guy about our drinking experiences, talk about the phenomenon of craving and the insanity that precedes the first drink. We go there armed with the facts. It says if he's an alcoholic, he will understand you at once. He will match your mental inconsistencies with some of his own. And I like to stop here where it says, if you are satisfied that he's a real alcoholic, am I satisfied who I'm talking to is a real alcoholic? Or they need to go maybe elsewhere. Am I satisfied he or she's a real alcoholic? I sponsored a couple of guys, like the gentleman I told you earlier, the heroin addict. I sponsored another guy who I was convinced was not a real alcoholic. The guy shared his story with me. He never talked about drinking. And I probed. I had considerations for him. I questioned. The guy never talked about drinking. And it was struggling in AA for years. And am I satisfied? Our ego will say, I have to work with everyone. But God will direct me to who I have to work with and who needs to work with me. I keep talking about armed with the facts, and I like to close with page 18 in our book. And then we'll throw it out for questions. Bottom of the page, it says, the ex-problem drinker who has found this solution, who's properly armed with the facts about himself, can generally win the entire confidence of another alcoholic in a few hours. Bill and Bob talked to that guy for 1 hour. I sat with a guy named Vince Dowling in Manhattan, and he doesn't mind that I break his anonymity. He's sober, well, close to 50 years now. And I sat with him, and in 15 minutes, he had me. I walked into his office, and he began to tell me his story and where he had been. And it's the first time in my life, I said, someone knows me, knows about me. Another person knows. He's eaten at the same dumpsters, slept in the same sort of hallways, had the obsession to drink alcohol, had the phenomenon of craving, lost everything worthwhile in life. And here's this man sitting before me. The guy looked just like Dr. Bob. Do you have any idea what he looked like? I says, he resembles nothing of his story. What did he do that he's sober this many years? At the time, he was sober 30 years. What did you do? And there was an immediate bond and an immediate trust. Until such an understanding is reached, little or nothing can be accomplished. That the man is making the approach has had the same difficulty. He obviously knows what he is talking about. His whole deportment shouts at the new prospect, he's a man with the real answer. He has no attitude of holier than thou, nothing whatever except a sincere desire to be helpful. There's a story in the 12 and 12 where Bill pays a call on this guy, and the guy's asking him, like, you know, what's your angle? What are you here for? What are you trying to sell me? And I forget the exact word Bill used, but I'm not trying to sell you anything. I have a way out. I'm here to save myself. And I have a way out. Nothing to sell. I'll get you sober if you buy $100 worth of lottery tickets, you know, or, you know, donate some money to a charity or, you know, vote for me. None of that. I'm here to save you. And in doing so, I'll save me. That's it. It says nothing whatever except sincere desire to be helpful. There are no fees to pay, no axes to grind, no people to please, no lectures to be endured. These are conditions we have found most effective. After such an approach, many take up their beds and walk again. Thanks for listening.